table I was sitting on. I touched my right cheek. The swelling was down. In the glassy reflection of the nearest display screen, my face looked almost normal. Marguerite came back with a tray of cold cereal and fruit juice. "You did a blood transfusion," I said rather than asked. Standing beside me, she nodded. "Who gave the blood?"
"Captain Fuchs did," Marguerite said.
The expression on her face was unfathomable. Quite serious, like a judge about to sentence a felon to a very long term. But there were other things in her eyes as well. She looked away from me.
"He's the only person on board who has a blood type similar enough to yours."
I chewed on a mouthful of cereal, then swallowed. It tasted bland, pointless. "Maybe it'll give me some of his personality," I muttered. Marguerite did not smile.
"No," she said. "I wouldn't want to see that happen."
Before she could say anything more, Fuchs himself pushed through the hatch. Suddenly the sick bay was overcrowded. I felt distinctly uncomfortable. But I lifted my chin a notch and said, "Thank you, Captain, for saving my life." He sneered at me. "I couldn't afford to lose another crewman." Then, gesturing toward Marguerite, he added, "Besides, it wouldn't do to have Ms. Duchamp here accuse me of murder while I'm claiming your father's prize money. It would be just like your father to renege on the prize because I let his son die." I shook my head. "You don't know my father." "Don't I?" "He wouldn't care about my death." "I didn't say he would," Fuchs corrected. "I said he'd use your death to renege on giving me the prize." He stressed the word "me" ever so slightly, but enough for us both to hear it. I glanced at Marguerite. She wouldn't meet my eyes. "How soon can you resume your duties on the bridge?" Fuchs asked gruffly. Before I could reply, Marguerite said,
"He should rest, and..."
"I'm ready now," I said, pushing my tray aside. Fuchs made a sardonic little smile. "My blood must be doing you some good." He looked at his wristwatch. "Jagal's on the comm console at the moment. You can relieve her in 2 hours. Before either of us could say anything, Fuchs turned to Marguerite and asked with mock beneficence, "Will that be enough rest and recuperation time for your patient?" "Never mind answering. It'll have to do." Looking back at me, he said, "2 hours." Then he grasped Marguerite's wrist and led her out of the sickbay. He held her possessively, like a man who felt he owned her. Marguerite glanced back over her shoulder at me, but she went with Fuchs without a word of resistance, without a moment of hesitation, leaving me sitting there, hot anger welling up in my gut. Wave Rider. I served my 8-hour watch on the bridge under Fuchs's sardonic eye. No sign of Marguerite. I should have eaten a bigger meal. I was ravenously hungry, but I gave no outward sign of it, except for an occasional growl from my hollow stomach. One of the burly, blank-faced Asians relieved me at the end of my stint. I got up and headed for the passageway, determined to find the ship's galley. But instead, Fuchs called to me. "Wait right there, Humphreys." I froze in place. He shouldered past me and through the hatch. "Follow me," he said, without turning back. He led me to his quarters, the compartment stuffed with books and comfortable furniture. The bed was neatly made. I wondered where Marguerite was. "How do you feel?" he asked. "Hungry," I said. He nodded, went to his desk, and spoke into the intercom in that Asian language that might have been Japanese. "Sit down," he said, gesturing to one of the leather and chrome chairs in front of the desk. He himself took the creaking swivel chair behind it. "I've ordered dinner for us. It should be here in a few moments."
"Thank you."
"I wouldn't want you to starve to death on my ship," he said, with just the hint of a malicious smile.
"Where's Marguerite?" I asked.
The hint of a smile disappeared. "Where's Marguerite, sir?" he corrected.
"Sir."
"That's better. She's in her quarters, resting."
I began to ask where her quarters were, but before I could get the first words out, he jabbed a thumb over his shoulder.
"Her quarters are next to mine. It's the most comfortable compartment on the ship, except for this one, and it allows me to keep a close watch on her. Several of the crew members are very attracted to the young lady.
Not all of them male, Isa.
So you're protecting her?
That's right. None of them will dare try anything as long as they know she's mine.
Yours? What do you mean?
I saw his face cloud again and quickly added, Sir. Before he could reply, the door slid open and one of the crewmen carried in a large tray filled with steaming bowls. He parceled out the food between us, putting Fuchs's dinner on his desk and dropping legs from underneath the tray to turn it into a table for me. I shook my head inwardly at the contradictions I was seeing. Fuchs ran a tightly disciplined ship, yet there were touches of, well, luxury was the only word I could think of. He liked his creature comforts, obviously, although he didn't care to extend the same level of amenities to the rest of the crew. I looked around at the books that filled his shelves. Philosophy, history, poetry, fiction by old masters such as Cervantes, Kipling, London, and Steinbeck. Many of the volumes were in languages I did not know.
"Do you approve?" he asked with a pugnacious air.
I nodded, but heard myself answer, "I prefer more modern writers, Captain." He snorted with disdain. "I suppose we can dispense with the formalities while we're alone in here. No need to address me as Captain or Sir, unless someone else is in the room."
"Thank you," I said.
He grunted, almost as if embarrassed by his small concession. Then he pulled a small vial from one of the desk drawers, shook a few tiny yellow pills into his hand, and tossed them into his mouth. Again, I wondered if he was a narcotics addict. I tried to make out the lettering on the spine of the old book on his desk. Its leather cover was cracked and peeling.
"Paradise Lost," he told me. "John Milton."
"I never read it," I confessed.
"Very few have."
That made me feel rather uncomfortable. Fishing around in my memory, I came up with, "Isn't there a line in it that goes, 'Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven'?"
Fuchs grimaced. "Everybody knows that one. I prefer infernal world, and thou profoundest hell. Receive thy new possessor, one who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven."
He spoke with such fervor, such a dark, deep-rooted passion, that I was totally taken aback. I didn't know what to say.
"You may borrow it if you wish."
"What?"
"The book. You may borrow it if you'd like to."
My brows must have hiked up to my scalp. Fuchs laughed harshly.
"You're surprised at a show of generosity? You're surprised that I'm pleased to have someone aboard with whom I can talk about philosophy or poetry?"
"Frankly, I am surprised, Captain. I had thought that you'd want nothing to do with Martin Humphreys' son."
"Ah, but you forget. You have my blood in you now. That's an improvement, a vast improvement."
I had no reply for that. Instead, I began, "About Marguerite."
"Never mind her," he snapped. "Don't you want to know about my Lucifer? Aren't you curious about why my ship survived and yours broke apart? Aren't you wondering about where we are and how close we are to your father's prize money?"
"Is that all that interests you, the money?"
"Yes. What else is there? Your father took everything else from me. My career, the company I founded, my reputation, even the woman I loved."
I could see we were moving into dangerous territory, so I tried to change the subject to a safer ground. "Very well," I said. "Tell me about your ship." He stared at me for a long, wordless moment, gazing blankly, those cold, ice-blue eyes of his seemingly looking through me into another dimension. What was going through his mind, I have no way of knowing. His face went as blank as a catatonic's. He must have been revisiting the past, reminding himself of what he had lost, how he had reached this point in space and time. At last his broad, heavy-jowled face regained life. He shook his head slightly as if clearing it of painful memories.
"Over-design," he said at last. "That's what you learn when you stake your life on a vessel that's got to carry you across interplanetary distances. Over-design. That's the lesson I learned out in the asteroid belt. Bigger is better.